After the well-received AEW Revolution, I, like many others, was looking forward to what was going to happen next on Dynamite. What followed was one of the more disappointing Dynamites in company history. And look, it's not just me saying it. Based on cage match feedback, it was the second lowest rated by voters in company history, a history that dates back to October 2019. There are a few reasons for that, and I felt like exploring them with past guest and friend of the show, Jesse Collings of WrestleNomics and Voices of Wrestling. We talked about what went wrong with Wardlow, my personal rules for post-pay-per-view follow-up shows, and also the strange story of QT Marshall's tweet war with Wrestling Inc.'s Raj Geary that happened several days after the show. We also talk about Ring of Honor Honor Club numbers, whether Jesse is ready for a third hour of AEW TV, and even some WWE praise. I'm Josh Nason, and this is Josh Nason's Punch-Out. Well, it's been a while since Josh Nason's Punch-Out has been on the airwaves. The year in review series just, it took me out of it. Took me out of it completely, but I'm revived. And, almost 3 months later, here we are. We're back and ready for a strong final three quarters of this 2023. And joining me to kick things off to help me talk about some things that are on my mind, I know are always on his mind. Returning guest, Jesse Collings. He is seen all over the place on WrestleNomics. Of course, Voices of Wrestling, Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast and such. And Jesse, welcome back. And as we were talking about weather stuff before, I am looking at like 8 inches of snow, wet, heavy snow outside my window, and you have just rained. So lucky you.
Yeah, I don't have to take the car brush out. But I'm happy to come back on the show, Josh. I do like our you know, once every, 5 months or so, We get together and we talk about some of the issues in wrestling, and it's always a good time on the show. So I'm very happy to be back on it.
I agree. And like I said, I've been enjoying seeing you on WrestleNomics as of late. I say as of late because I am a new subscriber as of late. I believe in February, I finally decided to take the plunge, the $5 plunge. So more than enough compensation to help out the fellas. And yeah, you guys do some interesting stuff, and it's making my brain. I have to think of things a little bit differently because obviously I'm used to hearing business news kind of one way, the Meltzer way, so to speak. But you guys really, and Brandon obviously especially, just really kind of get into the numbers and really in deep into the numbers in a way that is good to work the brain. So yeah, it's been a fun experience watching it from a viewer perspective.
Well, thanks, Josh. I'll say this, and this isn't like a criticism of Dave in any way, shape, or form, but I do think there's really nobody in wrestling media who kind of like thinks about things the way Brandon does, and he's extremely dedicated to getting into the weeds, into researching details, and to coming up with some interesting stuff to talk about. And I'm a very, very small part of it, but he's worked extremely hard to find a real niche for a way to discuss things in professional wrestling, and a ton of credit to him for that kind of dedication, because it's, that he's getting a lot of recognition for, I think, not just from yourself, but from many people who respect the work he's doing, because it really is something that you're not going to really get anywhere else in wrestling media.
It's very unique. The sheets, it's legit business presentations of numbers and analysis. And yeah, we have not got to that level in terms of really kind of just how he presents it. Yeah, it's very unique, and it's a cool niche, and it's good to have in the market. So a couple things that were on my mind this week as we start a discussion. I'm going to lead off with one that I don't know has been talked about, extensively by the podcasters. I don't know if it has been a lot of think pieces yet written about this man. I know you have an opinion on him. I have right in front of me. But let's talk about last Wednesday's conclusion to AEW. And we're going to get to QT Marshall and his tweets. But I want to talk about Wardlow. And if you had asked me on June 1st, I believe, 2022, if you had asked me, how is Wardlow going to be a big star for AEW the next year? I would have said, absolutely, yes. Of course he is. Look at what happened the past few months of this run towards MJF. Look at the MJF match and look at the reaction. Look at how much the people have taken to him. They're white hot. As we sit here on March 14th, 2023, I would rescind that quite heartily. And I don't know what happened. I don't know. I know there's a little kind of blips along the way that we'll kind of get into. I know, your opinions on Wardlow we'll get into in a minute. But I came out of that Wednesday Dynamite. My thought was, I was like, what a very bad Fallout show. And I also thought, how did they screw this guy up so badly? And this is not a knock on Powerhouse Hobbs, because I like Powerhouse Hobbs a lot. I'm like, I don't understand where things went wrong. Your thoughts?
Right. So there's no real like key moment where they booked Wardlow to lose in a key moment or to look stupid. There's no like, remember like when Zack Ryder had some momentum and they put him in a wheelchair and Kane, he was feuding with like Kane and Kane took him in the wheelchair and like wheeled him off the stage.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Right. That was like a key moment for like, this is where it all went wrong for Zack Ryder.
I will tell you. So the two things that stuck out from the start. One was the follow-up in Los Angeles when MJF showed no ill will, no signs of like any type of severe beatdown that he had got just days earlier when he cut that infamous promo and went away. And I think there was a way, and I guess this was off camera, that CM Punk was the one to kind of run him out of the building. And to me, that could have been Wardlow on camera to do that if you're going to like completely kind of no-sell the effects of this, the end of this feud and everything like that. And I understand it's kind of was the start of where they wanted to go for this next thing, but I think you kind of did it at expense of the guy you were trying to get in this big position to begin with, who really kind of got overlooked in a lot of ways due to all the MJF stuff going on that weekend. The other thing was the follow-up feud was with a comedy feud with Mark Sterling and the 25-on-1 security, and it just wore down and wore down and wore down. And it just wasn't anything hot. And I think just the hot potatoing with the title, that was kind of, I wouldn't say the beginning of the end, cause you can rebound from that, but it was not a strong start. And then kind of culminating where we ended up, this past Wednesday. I don't know. I don't think there's any rebuilding him. I know, the suggestion, I think.
There's no rebuilding him. He's done.
Yeah, he's done. He's done. Let's start from there. He's toast.
But toast as what?
Toast as, so I thought when he, go ahead. You go.
So I just want to say like, so like you opened it up by saying like, you thought he would be like a big, like if we go back to Double or Nothing after he squashes MJF. You thought like, okay, he's going to be a big star. I guess like to start with the very basic definition of like, what do you mean by big star? I think that's a fair question to ask of anybody. Like, right. Like a lot of the times we in wrestling, like, oh, they're going to be a big star. They're going to be a big draw one day. Like, what do we mean by big star? Do we mean world champion?
Yeah.
Do we mean by like the face of the promotion? Do we mean by maybe somebody that's on TV every week? To follow up, like when you're like, he's done, like, do you see him like he's done? I'm going to assume you mean like he's done as potentially being like a world champion figure in AEW.
Good question. And I always think the same thing when other people say like big star, they kind of throw that out there as kind of a catch all. And
it's liberally used sometimes.
Oh boy. Oh, I just did it myself. I'm getting the rust out. That's what I'm doing. Yeah. I would say when I say star, I thought he would be, if you had asked me in May or June 1st, wherever it was, I would have said a top five singles, I almost said star, draw in AEW in terms of like seen at that upper level, not in terms of in ring, but I thought that he could have been kind of the one of the not the monster, but kind of just the outlier, but like in the mix, because people were just so into him. I don't know. Again, a lot of things can change in the year. I mean, look, we've seen I think to an extent, Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks kind of cooled off a little bit and they returned. And I thought, didn't think that was possible, but just seems to be kind of like the way things are going. I thought he would be a difference maker in terms of like just that people will be into him. And I thought that you could probably have him as a legit world title contender. If you had asked me a year ago, I'd say for sure he's on that path. That's what I would have said then.
Yeah, I think like with AEWs, I feel like there's an informal tiering system to their stars, like their especially their top male single stars. Like I would say the top stars in AEW, the real top stars right now are Jon Moxley, MJF, Bryan Danielson, Chris Jericho, and Hangman Page. I would throw Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks in as like acts, but because there are trios, I'm not going to include them at the moment, but just as your single stars. And this is the kind of class that I think you would ideally want Wardlow to be in, would be like that class, like five or six guys who are going to have a match on every pay-per-view.
Yep.
Which I think is kind of a real sign of, I think, stardom in AEW, is if you have to be on the pay-per-view. Like AEW is never going to do a pay-per-view, you know, barring injury, where Chris Jericho is not going to have a match, or Jon Moxley's not going to have a match, or MJF's not going to have a match. Like barring injury or anything, if they're healthy, they're going to be booked to have a match, and it's probably going to be a match of prominence. That I think is the kind of like a realistic level that you should want to be in. And Wardlow's not at that level. Wardlow could have, he did have a match on Revolution, but he didn't feel like he had to be on the show. And now I would consider that a problem as far as a not an ideal way place for him to be at the moment.
Yeah. So at the time, March 8th, and actually you wrote a column about this, which we should check out at some point too. March 8th, you wrote, Wardlow's a talented guy, but I think his ceiling might be as an upper mid-card challenger type. Some folks think because of the look, he needs to be a main event guy, but I'm not sure if he is dynamic enough for that role. And that was after, Dynamite. And yeah, I think we're never going to find out if he could have been in that upper mix. Again, in ring, there was probably going to be some point, again, with the talent level, he could have got quote unquote exposed a little bit, but I think sometimes you can overcome that. Not every promotion. I mean, even WCW was heights. There was a mix of everything, and you saw the guys just kind of work it out, you know, and things kind of just figured themselves out. And I think at AEW to an extent, things have kind of figured themselves out too, where everyone kind of has their niche and their thing. I don't understand. As you kind of have gone through, do you think there was a singular moment or a trend or something like that that kind of portended the end?
I don't, a singular moment, no, but I could tell you one thing I noticed pretty much right off the bat. Once he kind of got that push, you could say it's like that, the long Mark Sterling kind of feud. But even, you know, you can go right to his match at Revolution against Samoa Joe from last week, is that when he would wrestle, the fans didn't care about what he was doing in the ring. Like the fans popped for his entrance and they would pop for the powerbomb spot, but they didn't want to see him sell and they didn't want to see him have like a regular wrestling match. He was they didn't care about his character enough to be invested in kind of the roots of what a wrestling match is. They only cared about the entrance and like the you know, his powerbomb spot and wanting him to do a bunch of powerbombs. And I think that when we talk about like in-ring work, I think that's like a critical component. I think like fundamentally, Wardlow's fine as a worker. He doesn't botch spots. He's, you know, he's got good power moves. He's agile. He could do some really cool stuff. Like, I don't think that he is like this like terrible in-ring performer that is a liability out there from like a fundamental perspective. But he wasn't able to get the people invested in his matches from a beginning to end standpoint. It was kind of just for those key moments like the entrance and the finish. And that was like, okay, this is kind of troubling because people are into the idea of Wardlow and people are into like the key aspects of him, but until they're really fully invested in him, that's going to put a cap on his ceiling. Now, if you want to, I think it's then fair to say that, well, was he booked for people to be invested in him like that? And I would say he probably wasn't. But I do think that he was given a fair chance to get people invested in him. I don't think he was jobbed out. I don't think he was booked to look incompetent the way you see we've seen some historical slip-ups where guys get their legs cut off of from under them. But I don't think he I just I think of that I think it comes down to dynamicism, really. Like, if we talk about that, if we look at that top tier of AEW talents, and then we think of Jon Moxley and Chris Jericho and MJF and Hangman Page, and we think about what those guys bring to the table from a charisma standpoint, what those guys bring to the table from a promo standpoint, what those guys bring to the table from an in-ring standpoint, they're just a level above Wardlow at this point of his career. I'm not saying he's toast. I'm not saying that he's never going to get there. But you can't, like, even someone like Ricky Starks, if you're telling me, like, who can I push to the top? Can I push Ricky Starks or can I push Wardlow? Ricky Starks to me, or Swerve Strickland, or maybe these other guys that are kind of in the upper mid-card level trying to make that leap. Those guys to me, bring more to the table as dynamic performers than Wardlow. And so my general point is, I think that this the level he's at now, which is like an upper mid-card challenger title, that might be his ceiling. And on and related to that, that's not like a total failure. It's not like if he's never the he it's not like if he never wins the world title, his career is a failure. Because there's only a few people that are ever going to be able to hold that AEW championship the way that they book it. It's very protected. And so I think there's nothing wrong with Wardlow maybe maxing out at this level. Could he have reached a higher level with better booking? Yeah, anyone could. But I don't see it as necessarily like this malpractice moment that maybe some other people do.
I see it as a you had a guy that again, you see the people pop that big, you just kind of try to figure out how to feed it, you know? And I you just it, to me, you figure out a way. And like, so I'm looking at the post Double or Nothing run. So on that aforementioned Dynamite in Los Angeles, he beat JD Drake in 71 seconds. And then after that began this feud. I think it might have been on that night. He didn't wrestle again till 2 weeks later, which was the 20-on-1 handicap elimination match. And then it was July 6th that he beat Scorpio Sky in a street fight for the TNT title. And then he went on a pretty good run from there. But it's almost like that month after, and this is something I feel like we see a lot in AEW, is just there's the post, it takes a while for some of these the post pay-per-view storylines to kind of really get going again. Like they focus on one, but everything else takes a while to get there. And I don't know if they had a plan for him or just they thought that the Sterling thing was going to be better. But I mean, he's such like a comedy character. I don't know. It just didn't really seem like it went anywhere. And again, it ended with that
Right.
big elimination match.
He felt hot coming off of the MJF feud, and they didn't necessarily follow that up right away with something hot. They gave him a squash feud where he could beat up some, can beat up JD Drake in under 90 seconds, and he can powerbomb 20 security guards. And then he wins the TNT title from Scorpio Sky, which I think, like, what if you took that TNT title match and made it like the night after
Yes.
Double or Nothing? Cut
Right.
out that month or so, a little more than a month, where it took him, and then suddenly he's got the title. But I don't know, like, if he had, like I said, it comes back to like dynamicism. If he had, like, wouldn't he had he shouldn't have he had more shouldn't he have shouldn't he have had more resilient if he was really as talented as like a main event wrestler should be, like, shouldn't he have had more resiliency where he could survive like a month of kind of meh booking before getting the title shot? Like,
Yeah, I think, and I'd have to go back to see the segments and things like that. I just remember at the time thinking like, it just doesn't seem like good, you know?
yeah,
I don't know. And
right.
then,
And I agree with your point in the sense that I think AEW has this, and I don't know if it's, I don't even want to say it's necessarily a problem, but it's something that's interesting to note with AEW. And the Wardlow MJF feud is a good example of this, in the sense that a feud with MJF, who was a top star by that point, is like the best you can do in AEW for the most part, because you're on TV every week. You're going to be in some sort of level of main event position. And it's a really great time for you to get over working against a skilled opponent that is going to, especially as skilled of a heel as MJF is going to be, he's going to get make it easier for you to get cheered. Because that's ultimately what a skilled heel's job is to do. And I think after you're done working with MJF, it's hard to follow that up with something with the equivalent of that. I think this has become a case with a lot of Chris Jericho's feuds. There's a lot of talk about how no one really benefits from maybe working with Chris Jericho. I've seen that take a lot, that like you feud with Chris Jericho, and even if you beat him, then what happens? You're not as over as you are afterwards. And I think like part of that is like because feuding with Chris Jericho is like the basically like outside of winning the world title, like the number one thing you can do in AEW. And unless you use that feud to springboard yourself into a top position, what you're going to do is probably not going to be as important as feuding with Chris Jericho. I think like Ricky Starks, like he's going to looks like he's going to feud with Juice Robinson post Revolution. And it's like, okay, that's a feud for Ricky to remain on TV and to get a win. But it's inevitably going to feel like he's taken a step back because he's not feuding with Chris Jericho anymore. Just like it inevitably felt that Wardlow was going to take a step back once he was done feuding with MJF, unless he was going to win the world title or he was going to go feud with Jon Moxley or one of the few other equivalent stars in AEW, it was always going to be felt like a step back. Because unless you're one of those like five or six absolute top stars, everything you do is always going to feel like it's a little bit smaller if you're not working with them.
Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah, I just think it was not fully realized, and I the other thing, his one potential saving grace that he had, I wish they'd explored this more. And this was kind of one of my issues with how they laid out the initial AEW Trios title tournament. So but he this is such a random match. He teamed in All Out 2022. He teamed with FTR against Jay Lethal and the Motor City Machine Guns. And it just a random kind of like pull things out of a hat. We're going to get this done. And like they didn't really explore that Trios team that much. Like they had one match on Dynamite and then followed up by the All Out match, and that was it. And I don't know. Like there is one shot if they want to do an extended Trios run. Again, FTR doesn't seem to kind of be really in that lane right now. There could be something there, but that was another thing where they just kind of like they started kind of this alliance and then they just kind of just let it falter. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to present him at this point. I don't know if he just do you think he doesn't seem to be a type to like fall out of favor like he did something, but maybe they just are just kind of like it's this is they th maybe they think this is good. I don't know.
I think that they understand his ceiling. Like I think people I like this is a big thing for me with in my article that I wrote for Voices of Wrestling, which is like he comes off that feud with MJF, and that this is this that feud with MJF where he looked so good in it by the end of it, and he was so over, people wanted to see him kill MJF, right? That was a feud that took years to craft from the moment Wardlow debuted in the company in 2019 until Double or Nothing 2022, 2.5 years. He was MJF's lackey. He was MJF's manservant. He was his employee. He was doing his dirty work. They teased that he was going to turn on MJF about 500 times before he actually did. And it was this whole thing that was built up, and he was working with MJF, who's like a, like a savant level heel. And like you, he was never, you were never going to be able to recreate that feeling after that feud was wrapped up. You had to start from scratch somewhere else. And could he been done, used better after the MJF feud? Sure. Should he have not feuded with Smart Mark Sterling and his crew and kind of just been pushed out of like this kind of like semi-comedy kind of wrong character? Sure. But I just don't think you can recreate that MJF match feeling. And I think some people maybe expected that to happen because that's what he looked like at Double or Nothing. And I just don't know how they could have kept that momentum going because they didn't have a almost 3 year storyline to kind of lean on to promote his character. What I've seen in the last 8 months, I don't know, it's probably almost, it's 10 months now. What I've seen is I've seen a guy who has ability, who can get over to a degree, but isn't talented enough to really justify a main event push. And I think that's hard for some people to admit. And I think that maybe if we, to me, like he's like kind of like, I made the comparison to Andrew Wiggins in my article, but he's kind of like a sports prospect who had a lot of potential. And we've now kind of seen what their career is like, and they're probably not going to reach the potential that maybe some people dreamed that they would, but they can still have a successful career.
Well, I guess we'll see what happens starting Wednesday. Where else are you going to get 22 minutes of Wardlow talk? You know what I mean? We go deep on this show, Jesse. Good job.
I could easily do 25 minutes more.
I know, me too.
And it is a big discussion point because I do think that if I mean I just I said like I don't think he has the talent to maybe reach that level, but I will say this, like you want different people kind of being pushed and being in control in AEW to a degree and presented as stars. And I think Wardlow, because of his, you know, he's got that classic pro wrestling look. He's different. And that's always good because he's also, I think he is talented. And he looks different and he can act different than Kenny Omega or Chris Jericho or Bryan Danielson. And I think that's definitely worth investigating further. I don't, like I said, I'm not as down on in the sense I don't think he's toast as a top guy, but I do think that he's got to become a better promo. And if he hits on some little character tweak and some sort of change, I always point to this. I feel like when Hangman Page first started in AEW, he wasn't that over. He was over, but he wasn't probably top guy over. And then a few months into his career, or a few months into AEW's existence, he kind of hit on the cowboy shit. Can I say shit on here? I'm sorry if
Of
I
course you can.
can't.
Yeah, go for
Okay.
it.
So he hit on the cowboy shit shtick. And that was just a little tweak, a little catchphrase, little tweak that I think took him to another level. And that it kind of pushed him into the main event. Yeah, he had a good storylines and stuff to get him there. And that might be all Wardlow needs. Just a little, not like a full repackaging, but just a little thing that gets over. And that can really boost you up. We see that kind of a lot in wrestling, is that guys hit on something, it gets over with the crowd, and it can kind of take someone who's maybe at a B level to an A level. And I think that's something that is certainly still in the cards for Wardlow.
Yep. Well, it'll be a challenge, and I guess we'll see. Maybe we'll see this Wednesday what happens. Real quick, what in a year before we go to QT's tweets, what to you constitutes a good to great Fallout show from a pay-per-view?
A good to great Fallout show? It's a good question. I haven't really thought about it that much. I would say it really depends on how a pay-per-view ends, right? Some pay-per-views end on kind of like cliffhangers, like All Out 2021, where Bryan Danielson and Adam Cole both show up. Right. That was kind of like a cliff, like it goes off the air and they're all looking at each other in the ring or whatever. That's like a cliffhanger. And so the follow-up for a show like that, you want to see like what's going to happen next. I would say that Revolution had a very definitive kind of feeling towards it, in the sense that it felt like most of the matches that took place were the end of feuds. It felt like that was the end of Ricky Starks and Chris Jericho. It certainly felt like it was the end of Christian Cage and Jungle Boy. Danielson and MJF, Moxley and Page definitely felt like the end to their feud, although I think that's kind of tying into their story. But so for a good Fallout show for post-revolution, I would say I would want to see what new directions the stars are going in after they've had these kind of like all these resolutions to their feuds. And that's what I would be most excited about. It doesn't have to be match heavy at all. But it should point to some new exciting directions, I think, for the top stars that are kind of, we all know, are going to start a new feud. Like, we know MJF is going to start a new feud. We know Ricky Starks is going to start a new feud. We know Chris Jericho is going to start a new feud. I want to find out what those feuds are going to be on the following Dynamite after Revolution.
So I have a couple rules because I've been thinking about this over the past week. Because the emotions I kind of felt watching that, I'm like, this is just, and I wasn't even really like looking at online stuff during the show. I was just kind of like how it made me feel. I'm like, this doesn't feel like we just had this really, really, really great pay-per-view just days prior. And I don't feel like it's really kind of, there's no momentum coming out of that. And to me, my rules are, and this is very WWE biased in terms of how I kind of came up watching TV, like most of us did. So I think that every pay-per-view, sorry, every Fallout show should start with a really hot video package of a couple minutes showing the key highlights of everything that happened, high energy coming out of that. And I know that this like video package thing becomes like a big thing with people. However, if 850,000 people watch Dynamite or whatever the number was, 830, whatever it was last week, 878. So not a fraction of that actually bought the pay-per-view, and with streamers and things like that, you're still not getting like even close to what, 20% maybe viewership or something like that in terms of like when it comes to actual people that watch the pay-per-view through. They know results and things like that, I assume. But there's a lot of people that they just don't buy the pay-per-views because they can't afford it or just don't want to. It should start with that. And to me, at some point, it doesn't have to be the opening 20-minute promo of the show. I think your world champion should always be in person on the Fallout show. Whether it is, if they're selling injuries, they don't have to be there long, but they have to be in the building to me. Like, that to me is important. And I think that always you're, like, to your point, it doesn't have to be wrestling heavy. Shorter matches are fine. But your main angle should be, there should be a nice, if there wasn't a nice bow on it, it should be wrapped up. But your top stars, to your point, they should have their next programs at least forecasted, hinted at something, and something that takes you out, something that the show leaves you with that's like, this is my hook, and I'm very excited to see what happens there. I don't think the Dynamite show, and I definitely know for sure the Rampage show, did not hit on hardly any of those. They had the MJF and Danielson promo. The Danielson promo, was a backstage thing and kind of in the moment. I can understand why they did that. But the MJF promo was kind of like buried at like, I think it was like half an hour in. No kind of like build to it or anything like that. He wasn't there. And I know they're doing the bar mitzvah thing this week, but you could have set that up with him in the building and so on. That's just got, like, going through like, do I have certain rules? I think you have certain checkboxes you have to hit. And I don't think they really hit any of those with that episode last week. And I thought that as the show was going on. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I thought the show itself was pretty mediocre by Dynamite standards. It's definitely not a Dynamite I'm going to remember. And you're right. Like, we don't really know. We have no idea who MJF is feuding with next, realistically. I think we'll probably find out with the Bar Mitzvah celebration that's coming up this Wednesday. But you're right, and we didn't get the video package. I think most people watching know the results from Revolution. But yeah, like, should they have hammered home certain aspects of it more? Absolutely. I think that for me, at least, I'm very intrigued by the Danielson promo. I don't think we're going to get a current result. I don't think we're going to get a resolution to that. Like, I don't think Danielson's coming back next week. So that's going to take some time. I thought the Moxley and Page segment slash kind of a, fight that they had. I thought I understand that's not for everyone, but I'm fascinated by that angle as well. So I'm higher on those two things. I think the Moxley and Page angle is I don't. I'm trying to avoid headcanoning this and like making up my own story, but I think it's one of the best book angles like I've seen on television in a really long time.
Oh, okay.
But outside of that, I didn't think the show was I didn't feel like the show was hot and lively, and I didn't think coming out of Dynamite on Wednesday night, I didn't think that I didn't have the same kind of like, yeah, double fist pump feeling that I had after Revolution, which was a few days before.
Yeah. Let's go to QT's tweets. So QT Marshall, who I should point out is a vice president of AEW. He was, of course, in that show closing angle with Powerhouse Hobbs, which I thought was completely flat. I don't know. Again, we talked about kind of the Wardlow thing. I think if you're going to have Powerhouse Hobbs win, I think he can do it on his own, but they really have this thing in terms of people aren't on their own in AEW. Everyone's like has to be in a faction or affiliated with other people. Like it's just kind of the way that Tony Khan likes things set up. And it was QT Marshall. And I mean, I would have loved it if you were going to pair him with somebody. I think the natural ones would have been maybe a revive the firm a little bit with Stokely Hathaway. You could have done, I mean, I was thinking like the wild one would have been Don Callis if you really wanted to have something completely like out of left field and have him kind of build maybe a group up or something like that with Hobbs and like Takeshita and something kind of very like unique if you wanted to do that. But I thought there were the other options if you wanted to align him with somebody. But I also think he was kind of fine act on his own anyway. So somewhere during the week, I know you initially missed this because of the you were on a ski trip.
Yes, I was blissfully unaware of this, Josh.
That slushing in the mountains and thankfully blissfully unaware of this, enjoying your time. But it was somehow he and Wrestling Inc.'s Raj Giri, who I think is I think he got bought out or something like that, or they sold it, whatever. He's like part
Raj
retired.
sold the web. Yes,
Yeah.
Raj sold the website to. Why can't I remember the name of the company? It's the same company that owns Mashable. They own a couple of other
Oh, okay, got it, got it.
Kotaku. I forget that. Why can't I? It's drawing a blank about this, but
Content Corp.
yeah, I
So,
forget what. Yeah, okay, anyway.
yeah. So then, some reason like Raj did not like the angle and kind of went public with it. I don't know if he tagged QT, but so these two start like going at it like back and forth, and not in like a playful way, but like dropping F-bombs and like it was. I was like almost uncomfortable to read at points. Like what, like. I asked a couple of our guys, I'm like, what are these two doing? Like, it was just like, I don't know, just embarrassing in a way. And then on Sunday night, QT releases this basically this lengthy kind of notepad statement, and basically kind of justifying why he did what he did. And basically that he basically defending AEW, defending his talent, and basically just kind of defending why he was doing what he was doing, and defending, I've seen, what was this quote here, I've seen too many talents lose major opportunities due to some quote unquote expert having an opinion but also having a rather large following and creating a narrative that could potentially hurt someone's career. To me, that is excusable. Fans, journalists, and everyone in between can be extremely disrespectful, downright shitty to many talents that are literally putting their bodies in life for your entertainment. So for that, I always stick up for all talents. I mean, that's a pop the boys type thing. But I don't know. I was, and so I was out actually on, and he replied to a fan later saying, "Oh, I guess Tony Khan had a word with you," and he said, "No, not at all." And so I was outside, like I was on a walk on Sunday, and I was thinking about asking you to talk. Actually, we had something set up to talk, and I was just kind of thinking about stuff I wanted to talk about, and then I started thinking about those tweets, and I started thinking about the fact that I had completely blown over that he was a VP. And I was just thinking, like, if you're Tony Khan, if you're leadership or whatever, like, is this what you want your VPs wasting their time on? Is debating like wrestling writers to that extent, and to do it in a way that gets very, like, very personal, that they're sharing like DMs and things like that? I don't, I I'm just thinking, like, he's got this opportunity now, and maybe I bet he's probably a little annoyed that people were dumped on it so badly, but that's kind of the position. That's kind of how things work. But I'm like, why are you wasting your time doing this? It's a bad look for, I mean, it's a bad look for him, I think. And I don't get it. It's kind of leads in this big, like, more institutional control. Like, is this what Tony Khan wants? Does he condone this stuff? I don't know. It just, I had thought a lot more about it afterward than I thought I was going to.
Yeah, I have no idea what Tony's thoughts are on it. I think that AEW has both benefited and at other times not benefited from allowing their talents and allowing their employees to speak freely in a way that WWE talent does not. Mm-hmm. WWE does not allow its talent to. And there are benefits and negatives to that. There are benefits to allowing the wrestlers and the personalities to be themselves, to if they want to feel like they want to defend themselves on social media, then they're entitled to do that. And there's some negatives to it. I'm with you in the sense that I think like it's dumb for QT to say that, to kind of, you know, roll in the muck on Twitter with people. And like his whole explanation for why he did that, like he was saying, like, I've seen too many, you read the quotes, like, I've seen, you know, too many, you know, promising talent not get work, because have their reputations hurt or not be able to get work because someone on Twitter said something. And I'm sure that's true for like QT students at like the low independent level, that a few bad things online could maybe hurt their reputation and could prevent them from being booked. But QT is a professional wrestler he's a vice president at AEW. He's on a major wrestling show. Like his reputation is not, his ability to get work is not really going to be impacted by someone saying that they didn't like that they were in this segment. That seems kind of like a stretch to say that that's why you're making the argument, to make it seem like you're swinging with this guy on Twitter because you're setting an example for what, for your indie wrestlers to also fight with Twitter people. That right. Seems bad. Like the whole thing, I think made QT look bad, and it made, you can certainly extrapolate that and say that it makes AEW look bad. I would say most people don't know. I also think that like sometimes we over-exaggerate like what kind of impact Twitter has and like how many people are aware of kind of people's behavior on Twitter to a degree that I don't know how negative it is for like AEW, but for me, it was kind of like why are you so bothered by this?
Yeah. And I was thinking about the, you know, kind of the, it's just wrestling aspect that I think people kind of just dismiss the business for this stuff. Like you mentioned, I don't know how many, you know, people really this affected. I'm sure if I was to say something on Twitter about this, that, you know, the AEW mob would come after me, as they partially did for an innocent question I had to Tony Khan like a week ago.
Really? What did you tweet?
Oh my God. I just asked, like, he mentioned this Orange Cassidy, when he booked Orange Cassidy, Jay Lethal 3. And he replied, Sean Ross Sapp did a tweet about just kind of the match or whatever, nothing negative. And Tony Khan replied to him, said one of the things he uses the first one was a box office draw. And they mentioned about ratings for the second one or something like that.
Yeah, I remember the tweet.
Yeah. And so I replied back, I'm like, box office draw. I'm like, I said, when I hear box office draw, I think of like ticket sales. Is that what you meant? Because I was curious if like this can't be like, Cassidy versus Lethal is not someone's going to buy a lot of tickets for, unless they have some unique, unless they're tracking this where they track ticket sales after
right. Like, do you have evidence like if you're going to claim that he's the box office draw, what is your evidence to suggest that he is a box office draw, specifically with tickets? Because I agree, when you say box office draw, I think of like, oh, did they sell 2,000 more tickets because of the match?
I was just curious. Like, I also was like, is that what you meant? And of course, like these people, and again, just these lowest of the low, and I'm just like, they're just immature and they just don't know. And they all, it just, whatever. Like, they act like this was the dumbest question ever, and I was attacking them. They're like, oh, this means that the ratings were up quarter over quarter for the last 3 months, and why would idiots like this even ask a question? I'm like, that's not even remotely what I'm asking, and there's no gotcha here. I'm legitimately asking because I don't have his number. He never answered it, of course. And I was just curious. Like, that's the thing, like, with this, how wrestling Twitter and the tribal is. Go ahead.
Doesn't it make you feel good, though, Josh, when, like, the people that are criticizing you are, like, you can easily, instantly dismiss them as, like, some of the dumbest members of our society?
Yeah, pretty much.
That happens to me. That happened. Yesterday, I got a, I'm not really high profile enough for this to happen to me all the time. And I'm sure for people like Dave, it does happen all of the time. But, like, you say something and a certain fan base gets very upset, and then they spend, you know, you look through your quote tweets and all this stuff like that. And, you know, I just have to laugh at some of this stuff because I'm like, wow, like, you know, these people clearly don't get it. And I don't feel any sensitivity to the criticism because I can just easily dismiss them as not knowing what they're talking about and not understanding where my tweet is coming from.
Right.
But I agree in the sense that these Twitter people, as we can call them, and they exist in, I'm sure, every fandom.
Of course. Yeah, I don't understand. I feel bad for some of them because, again, I'm sure a lot of them are young. They don't have anything else going on. And this isn't to insult. I think it's part of our society now where people are so addicted to social. And it's just, again, like if you don't have the life experience of dealing with and being able to ask reasonable questions and being able to criticize something without like saying you hate it completely, you know, I think that's what people assume. Like if you ask a question, it must mean you're trying to get someone or, you know, again, this constant defend the wall mentality that every bit of fandom, no matter what it is, has, political parties, pro wrestling, sports, movies. I mean, there was a trend a couple of weeks ago. There are still people that want Netflix to buy the Zack Snyder Snyderverse from Warner Brothers so Zack Snyder can continue his Justice League arc. And it's like, I'm like, what are we doing? Like, what's happening right now? It's
crazy. Can I speak in defense of the Snyder marks here?
Oh my God, go for it. I cannot wait to hear this.
Which I don't know that much. I don't really know that much about it, but realistically, isn't that logical though, that if they want to see more, if they really enjoyed the Snyder first movie or the Snyder cut, isn't it logical for them to then pine for the, you know, maybe Netflix will buy them. And so we can get more of this product that we enjoy. I don't think that's necessarily bad faith.
Well, I think, have you gone, and we are going way off the rails here, this is good. Have you heard anything about the, his Zack Snyder, how he's, basically motivated social media and his followers to essentially, I don't say harass, but kind of like directed towards Warner Brothers executives. Have you heard this whole story?
No, but I'm sure there's this vile underside
this goes a little bit deeper. I'll send you an article to read at some point. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
But yeah, I mean, like if you ask Tony Khan an innocent question and people get all defensive about it. And part of that is because, right, there are a bunch of people on Twitter who are extremely anti-AEW that are operating in bad faith.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
And that feeds into the paranoia that these people who are responding to you are. And they just assume, well, like, you know, like, oh, you're so stupid. Why do you hate AEW? Right. And so anyone that's just an innocent critic or an innocent person asking a question is now facing the wrath of these people that have been enraged by some bad faith actors in the community. And that's also a problem. I mean, it happens to me sometimes, you know, I'll say,
oh, yeah.
People would say that stuff about me. And I'd be like, really? I hate AEW? Me? Like, it happened a lot when, you know, what really exposed me to it, Josh, was something that I didn't even know existed was in the lead up towards the Forbidden Door pay-per-view. I came across that there were these hardcore American-based New Japan Pro Wrestling fans that hated AEW. And there was like this big divide between AEW fans and New Japan Pro Wrestling fans. And I was like, I mean, and I'm like, really? There are people that hate one of these two, like one and hate the other? Like, that is so strange to me. But it absolutely existed. And I like was blown away. I'm like, wow, like I can't believe that. Cause I was and still am a very loyal New Japan Pro Wrestling fan. Certainly before AEW was around, I would say New Japan was easily my favorite wrestling promotion. And it's like I'm happy that we have two options now that I really enjoy. And it's but we were led, but I was exposed to this divide between fans, and I was just shocked by that. WWE versus AEW, I understand, because that's a huge like cultural clash of the identity of American wrestling. But it can be brutal out there. It's not for the faint of heart.
Very true. Wrap up this final question. We'll give some equal time, WWE. Do we give them enough credit for being so, I won't say flawless, but really good at production, really good at things like Fallout shows? Granted, not every storyline is going to hit and so on, but I think just they do it, they put on, they promote their version of pro wrestling, sports entertainment, whatever you want to call it, in such a way that it's like they don't, like their production level is so high, everything looks great. Granted, they have, oodles and oodles and oodles of money in the bank. We get this. But still, people have oodles and oodles of money in the bank can screw up and make things look bad. They don't. And everything just hits. They're cruising into WrestleMania season. I think sometimes we kind of just like we overlook how just how a complicated dance that they have, but they always seem to nail it. Not with storylines and again, the Vince McMahon era and all this stuff. We know that, but like you don't ever think that a show is going to look bad. I don't ever think like video. They're not going to fully explain the story to people that don't watch or partially watch, or I don't know. I think they sound we take them for granted how good they are at what they do, even though it infuriates a good part of the fan base because the in-ring isn't what we want. Does that make sense?
I kind of understand what you're saying. I think there are certain elements of WWE's production that are the envy of the wrestling world, and there are certain elements of the WWE's production that I think are terrible.
Which ones are terrible? What do you think?
The excessive camera cuts, I think,
Yes, completely. That
are
awful.
terrible. And I'll tell you what, as someone who has stopped watching WWE week to week in the last few years and kind of only watches, I'll watch the pay-per-views and I'll watch certain aspects of Raw and SmackDown. The two things that jump out to me as like, oh my God, I can't watch this, are the camera cuts and the commentary. And so in that, I think it's very different here. If I were to say, what is something that AEW should do that WWE does, is I think WWE does an excellent job, and this might go back to like our discussion of a Fallout show. WWE does an excellent job of working very hard to portray their top wrestlers as big stars who are paramount to every show that they're on. And you could argue maybe they're slightly overexposed, but if you want to talk about Cody Rhodes or Sami Zayn or the whole Bloodline group or people like that, Edge right now, like the people who are kind of in big roles heading into WrestleMania, those people are all over the show. Cody is in hour one, he's in hour two, he's in hour three. And they really go all out. Seth Rollins is another one. Like, they really go all out in presenting those people as these major pivotal figures on the show, and they're all over the product. And it gives off the impression, I think, that they're bigger stars, as opposed to AEW, who, and they've dabbled this with MJF a little bit, but for the most part, like, even if you're a big star, you get like your 10-minute segments on Dynamite, and that's it. Now, having the 3-hour Raw and the 2-hour SmackDown, which is 5 hours of first-rate television each week, gives them more leeway to fill this out. But I do think that WWE does a better job presenting their wrestlers as bigger stars. And when you have something like a post-match, post-pay-per-view fallout, and you want to see what the big stars are doing, WWE does do that in a way that AEW doesn't. And that would be like my number one thing I think AEW should take from WWE, is that kind of presentation of their stars. I think the commentary, I think caters to the lowest common denominator, and they hit you over the head with everything. And I personally, as a fan, can't stand it. But I could also maybe understand the logic that's being put on display, in the sense that you do explain it to everyone many, many times so they understand the story, as opposed to AEW, which I think asks its audience to do a little bit more critical investigative work on their end to fully understand the story. And maybe that's not the best way to convey your storylines.
Yeah, I think maybe that's kind of where my mind was more at when I was asking that question, was the fallout, again, going kind of back to the Fallout show conversation and so on. One other thing with that, are you looking forward to more AEW TV, another hour every week, assuming this story is true, which at this point it probably is?
Am I looking forward to it? No, because and the only reason I say that is just like I just don't have the time to watch all this wrestling, Josh.
It's hard.
I watch I watched the only show I watch pretty much every week when it's on live is Dynamite. Everything else I have to watch afterwards, like Rampage, I try to catch on the weekends, but I don't watch it every week. I haven't watched any of Ring of Honor yet, and I'm sure if I sat down and I watched the Ring of Honor show, I'd be like, this is some good stuff. I'm glad I watched this. I just don't have the time. Like, I don't know how people watch. I don't know how people watch Raw and SmackDown every week. That's an extra 5 hours on top of that. And so it depends. I guess it depends on when it's going to be on, and like if I'm going to be around to watch it. I have no doubt that the show will be good, and the show will be relatively easy to watch depending on how long it is. But I think as I've seen with Rampage, like Rampage, I think Rampage is a good wrestling show in the sense of every time I turn it on, I'm like, this is real easy to watch. The matches are pretty good. Sometimes there's good promos, sometimes there's good angles, but it's not essential viewing. And that's where I probably think this new show will be. If it's an in-ring live show, it'll probably be good, but it's probably not going to be essential viewing unless AEW dedicates the time to do that, which I don't think it's going to if Rampage is any indicator.
Yeah, I haven't seen, going back to too much stuff, I haven't seen any Ring of Honor stuff at all. That's like, I thought it was going to be an hour show, maybe could sneak in at some point. That's like another 2 hours a week.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Now, it might not be 2 hours every week, right? One of the interesting things about Ring of Honor is that the show can kind of be as long as they want it to be. The episodes can be as long as they need it to be. But yeah, you're right. Like 2 hours every week. Like, I'll tell you what, Josh. I work from home half the time. I was working home from today. Did I watch some of the New Japan Cup today when I was working? Absolutely. I have like and even with that, like I have a real hard time watching as much wrestling as I feel like I want to or as much as I can. And that's without watching Raw and SmackDown every week. Imagine if you're a loyal Raw and SmackDown viewer, like that's even more to watch. It's just it's impossible to for me to follow all of this wrestling all at once, and I'll be honest, I don't lead a particularly busy lifestyle. I don't have a family. Like I don't know, I don't know how people have the time to watch all of this. And so the answer is I'm happy that AEW is getting another show because I think it's a sign of at least health, a healthy relationship between AEW and its broadcast partners, and a good sign that that despite some rumors and whatnot, that Warner Brothers Discovery is committed to AEW and sees AEW as a vital aspect of its company, and that's excellent for the long-term health of AEW. So I'm happy that kind of announcement is being made. But just personally as a fan, no, I have no excitement for it because I'm probably not going to be able to watch it.
Yeah, I wonder when they would tape it, or if maybe one of the Dark Elevations, like Dark Elevation, maybe that turns into a tape. I don't, because imagine, I mean, you've been in these Boston shows when it's like 11:30 and maybe they've had one match into Rampage, and it's like, oh my god, how long is this? You know, I mean, that,
oh, it, Josh, when they taped Rampage in, when I went, you weren't at the Worcester show, correct?
Right.
I went to this Worcester show, and they had a really nice crowd at the DCU Center. Oh, it's, you know, I would say I think it was at like 5,500, like really nice crowd for Dynamite, hot crowd into stuff. They started taping Rampage, and I would say there was maybe 1,800 people left in the building mm-hmm. by the time Rampage wrapped up. And a lot of it was because people, if you're coming from the Boston area, you would have had, you know, you're looking at like an hour ride home at least. And just like, so yeah, are they going to make these tapings even longer? Are they going to have it like, is it going to be like maybe taped in Orlando, like where they tape Ring of Honor and where they tape the, you know, Dark Elevation now? Are they going to make Rampage's live taping every week?
That's what I was wondering too. Yeah.
And then you do an hour of Rampage and an hour of this other show. I will say this. They haven't really announced any, they've announced nothing for this other show. I would think that like something like a woman's show would almost make the most sense. Not necessarily because I would be that much more excited to watch it, but I do think it kind of, makes the show different than Dynamite or Rampage, and it might make it more worthwhile if stuff is happening on that, than as opposed to it literally being a C show, like, you know, Main Event is for WWE.
One other question before I let you go. It came up about Ring of Honor. I thought that 12,000 paid number felt low, and for the
pay-per-view
for Honor Club.
Oh, 12, for how many people?
12,000 subscribers. Yeah. It did not, if I'm a talent seeing that, I mean, maybe they don't care, but it's like, you know, obviously people get shit on, you know, whatever, streaming afters, and I guarantee there's probably more than 12,000 people watching it, but mm-hmm. you have to hope that everyone subscribing is watching it. I guarantee you some password sharing going on, but still, like,
yeah,
it's not a big audience for that. I don't know. I was underwhelmed by that. I was thinking, like, is that, you know, the 1.2 million a year, whatever, if that number, say it hovers around there. I mean, it could grow, but I mean, is that better than just being on YouTube and getting a lot more and just selling ads or something like that? I don't know. I was underwhelmed by that number.
I mean, Tony Khan is an extremely wealthy man.
Yeah.
So I'm never really worried about like, oh, is AEW making a profit? Is like, I'm like, well, like unless they're losing like $100 million a year, they're probably not going to just cease to exist. Tony's obviously very committed to it, and he has very, very deep pockets. He has a lot more money than Jim Crockett did. Did you know that, Josh?
I've heard that. Yeah.
But put that in perspective, like 12,000 people are watching Ring of Honor each week. Like as opposed, like we think Rampage is bad. Rampage has 450,000 people watching each week. So, you know, they're now doing what was Impact's
Discovery or something, or were the hunting outdoor?
They were on
network?
Destination America, but I think, right. Wasn't there an even, and then they were outdoor, on Pop.
Yeah. And the Outdoor Life, I think was the last one, something like that.
Yeah. They're in a better spot now, I think, on Access, but like there was one where that like you're doing that kind of viewership. My interpretation of the Ring of Honor television deal, like the Ring of Honor Honor Club thing, is that that is merely a parking spot for the product, while Tony continues to search out a better, more prominent television deal somewhere.
Yeah, I would say so.
I mean, they're getting this extra show they're getting this extra hour. And I would wonder, you know, they probably like the AEW branding over the Ring of Honor branding, but mm-hmm. wouldn't it make more sense to just put Ring of Honor on for that third hour?
That's what I wondered as well. But then again, I wonder if they're like, you know, we want the AEW brand. We don't want another brand to confuse people. I want from a Warner perspective, again, they may not be wrestling fans, and they're kind of like, why would we, that more people would tune in for this based on, you know what I mean? I think they'd probably just like the branding better.
Yeah. And I will say this. I thought that a Ring of Honor show would hold the audience better than Power Slap did.
True.
If you're putting it on after Dynamite, you know, and they were immediately losing 75% of their audience or whatever. I think a Ring of Honor show would have done better. I don't know, maybe it would have been cheaper than Power Slap, but they obviously gambled on that and didn't work out. And it's that's, that's what TV stations do. They'll gamble on a lot of different properties and hope that one of them pans out.
Well, before I let you go, Jesse, of course, mentioned at the top of the show, you write and talk for several different outlets on the game of pro wrestling. Go ahead and give your plugs and where people can watch you and hear you and read your work. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say obviously like just following me on Twitter at Jesse Collings is probably the best place to just keep up to date with all of the stuff that I'm doing, because that's where I'll publish, links and stuff like that. But writing for voicesofwrestling.com. I also have a podcast on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network. It's the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, and you can find that on any major podcast app, your Spotify's, your Apple Podcasts, your Amazon's, YouTube, any place you want to find your podcast, you can find it. Also, I'm a co-host of WrestleNomics. We are live every Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern time. You can also find WrestleNomics on pretty much any podcast streamer as well. That's me and Brandon Thurston and Chris Scullo taking an analytical approach to the business of pro wrestling. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all of my plugs. And like I said, it's always a good time to catch up with you, Josh, when I don't see you at AEW shows.
That's right. That's right. As we wear our AEW gear, we collect our
our we get checks. our big. I believe you get a check and I just get a big green bag with a money sign on it.
Yeah, I get the comically large fake check, you know what I mean?
And yeah, like the golf tournament winning check.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just to show everybody how co-opted I am and all that. Still have not working on that deal with WWE too, but and obviously I'm in the bag for Impact Wrestling, of course, and yeah, I can be totally bought, of course, all of us can.
Yeah, we're all open for business.
That's true.
I was thinking we got to be due for a Dynamite. It's been a while.
Yeah, right? It has been, what was it, last November? Yeah, it was a couple weeks before Full Gear, right?
Yeah, it was right before Survivor Series, too. Because remember, yes. Survivor Series was in Boston. Yes. So it must have been, I would say, I think it was early November. Hmm. And we get about two a year, and there hasn't been one announced. So I hope that we'll maybe get one in the summertime. I know Rampage is going to be in Kingston, Rhode Island.
Yes. In April. Battle of the Belts.
Is it a Battle of the Belts?
Yes. Yes.
So it's a Rampage and Battle of the Belts?
Yep. Yeah. And their debut in Rhode Island.
Yeah. And it's even further for you. I think it's like 2 hours from me. So I don't know if I'm going to make it down there.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll take a little spring vacation down to Narragansett and stop at the University of Rhode Island for a little Rampage. We'll see.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, I'm going to guess. Yeah, I'm going to guess summertime. Maybe if they choose to do if they want to bring Ring of Honor, like Death Before Dishonor back to Lowell, if they see that as a stronghold for them, or at least they want to try to do that again, they could do, I think, what they did. Well, last time it was the Worcester. They back to back with the Worcester and mm-hmm. and Death Before Dishonor. I could see them doing a Boston Ring of Honor kind of double dip there, something like that.
Well, I'd certainly welcome that if we get the Ring of Honor, if we get another Ring of Honor show this year.
Actually, do you remember when he said at the last Boston show, when he kind of hinted at maybe a pay-per-view in Boston? Do you remember that when he came out and stayed?
I remember it. I certainly, Tony just says stuff. Maybe he says that in a lot of cities. But I would say that I certainly do remember that. And he said, I believe he said something, maybe not in this building, but which would imply that it would probably be at the TD Garden if they were to do a pay-per-view.
Right.
And I mean, I personally, like, super selfishly speaking, that I think Boston would be a great city for a pay-per-view.
Yeah, it would have to be Full Gear. I would assume, I don't think he'd do Forbidden Door here in June.
Yeah, I mean, he could, but you're right. And I don't know, I don't know how good of a business model this ultimately is. I guess it makes sense for tradition's sake, and we're starting to get to the point where it is becoming a tradition for people because it's happened a few years in a row. The fact that they only have two and maybe now three touring kind of pay-per-view brands, I don't know if that's, the best decision in the world. Like the fact that Double or Nothing and All Out have to be in the same cities every year. And right. that means you only have two and then three if you want to add pay Forbidden Door to for the like literally the rest of the country or the world to have. I don't know if that's like the best.
Yeah, at some point they're gonna have. I would assume they're gonna have to break out of it. But again, he's so big on the tradition thing. But you're right; it does hurt kind of those bigger events from going to a Los Angeles. For example, like you look at some of the markets that they ran in for the first time. Obviously, they're gonna be huge. But like, imagine a big pay-per-view or an All Out or whatever in Seattle or something. You know, or like a
Toronto would have been a big
Boston,
one.
Toronto. Yes, I mean, there's so many markets all over the place that I'm sure would love to have a pay-per-view and draw really well for it. But yeah, we can when you only have two of them, I guess we'll see what happens with Forbidden Door. But yeah, it should seem that they should kind of rotate those around a little bit
Yeah,
more.
and you know, if they sell out Chicago and they sell out Las Vegas every year at high ticket prices, then like it's hard to blame them. But I do think it's kind of a like it's kind of a it's really hard to sell the pay-per-view. It would be good for the brand, I think, if they moved it or moved the pay-per-view events, you know, around more often than they do.
Yeah, and it'd be nice. I think a lot of the fans that go to All Out would appreciate if it was in the United Center or something, or a place a little bit bigger that was a little bit easier to get tickets to. But I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, he likes the tradition aspect. I agree that you know that makes sense. And you know, they've got other things. They've got, you know, it looks like I bet you, it seems like they're gonna probably try to make Grand Slam an annual thing. So that's
Yeah.
kind of like an annual event in New York, and they usually buff up that card pretty good. I actually there's a rumor going online that Forbidden Door this year is gonna be in Toronto.
Really?
Yeah, it has something to do with like a date being if you look at the calendar for the former Air Canada Centre, I believe it's called the Scotiabank Arena now, but the where the Raptors and the Maple Leafs play, I believe is a potentially Forbidden Door date there. But I like Forbidden Door in Chicago. Like it was great that they ran the United Center. That's a huge building. But it was also like okay, so sure, and obviously they sold out both of these shows. So like, it's not necessarily a bad decision move. But it's like man, Chicago gets Forbidden Door, and then a few months later they also get All Out. Seems like a lot.
Yeah, I would agree. All right, well, great job as always. Good catching up, and always we splinter off in some very random subjects, but it's always good to talk about. And we look forward to having you on a little bit later this year, Jesse Collins. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks, Josh.
All right, big thanks to Jesse Collins for stopping by. And yeah, it was good to get back on the show. Looking at lining up some interviews here for the next couple months or so. I've been trying to, but I've been unsuccessful with some people. I think I got some bad contact information. So we're going to open it up to some good interviews coming up here over the next few weeks. And yeah, I did, before I let you go, you might be wondering, what are the other lowest rated AEW Dynamites of all time? And I was curious myself. So this is from Cage Match. I should point out, so Cage Match, this is not like thousands of people, but pretty consistently like over 100 people. So, you know, this does have some relevancy, I guess. So this was the 99th edition of Dynamite. This is from August 25th, 2021, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So this show featured, let's see, Orange Cassidy versus Matt Hardy. There was a AEW World Tag Team Title Eliminator match with Lucha Brothers against the Varsity Blondes. That was the match there. Jamie Hayter defeating Red Velvet. Darby Allin, Eddie Kingston, and John Moxley defeating the Wingmen. Six-man tag team match. The Gun Club defeated the Factory. And Malakai Black defeated Brock Anderson. That feels like a very, very light lineup, even looking back on it. Sometimes you look back at some of these lineups, you're like, oh wow, that was pretty good. But yeah, this was not a good, really a good lineup at all. So that's kind of interesting. So that was the lowest rate at 4.63 for a rating. And then, of course, with the one this past week, and the third also took place in 2021. That was the Friday Night Dynamite. This got a 4.84 rating. This was from June 4th, 2021. So AEW Dynamite number 87. Let's see what this line. So again, this is from Jacksonville. We had the Young Bucks defeating Death Triangle. We had the Factory defeating the Nightmare Family. So Anthony Ogogo and QT Marshall versus are taking on Cody Rhodes and Lee Johnson. Christian Cage and Jungle Boy defeated Private Party. Red Velvet defeated the Bunny, and then Dustin Rhodes defeated Nick Comoroto. Yeah, so that's not a great lineup as well. The Young Buck. Yeah, this kind of goes in like match guide ratings. That's kind of how it pulls things in. And yeah, the Bucks and Death Triangle match, no big surprise. That rated very high, but everything else was rated very low. So that's kind of interesting how that works. I really don't look at it that much, but I saw on Russell Nomics, they were doing the kind of review on stuff and talking about a few things. They had a video, which you can find on their YouTube, talking about basically, you know, whether, what is the phrase about, whether essentially AEW is losing viewers or kind of what if they're losing fans or their fan base. Something like that happened over the past week, I guess, get a lot of views. You can check that out and see what they had to say about all that. So, yeah, without further ado, I'm going to say goodbye. Big thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to Jesse Collings, and I hope to be talking to you at some point next week. We're on the road to WrestleMania. Till next time, insert catchphrase here.